designed to convey a Christian worldview.
All right, it's my privilege to be here with Dr. Robert Delnay in part two of our interview for Sharper Iron. And in this part of the interview, we are going to talk about the Northern Baptist Convention. Dr. Delnay has done significant study and writing on the issue. And what happened in the Northern Baptist Convention, I think, has tremendous ramifications for even today. And so I wanted to take some time here and just investigate how it started, what the conflict was, what came out of the Northern Baptist Convention, and then what are the implications for fundamentalism. So, Dr. Delnay, why don't you start by giving us kind of a background to how the Northern Baptist Convention began.
Okay. To get it really brief, in 1707, the Philadelphia Association was organized, and there had been a lot of Baptists in this country, but now finally had an organization, a local fellowship, local association. Then with the ministry of Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice, they went to India as congregational missionaries, studied baptism on the way over, and when they got there, they were both Baptists. So now they didn't have anybody to support them. Luther Rice came back and organized a convention that would meet every 3 years and support Adoniram Judson. And so with that beginning, you now have a national organization, which was really a foreign mission board. Then things develop, more boards, especially the Publication Society and the Home Mission Society. And now you have Baptists all over the country, and now they've got these three national organizations. Civil War. In fact, even before the Civil War, the slavery issue divided them north versus south. 1845, the Southern Baptist Convention was formed. War's over, and they never did get back together again because now they had too many other issues. 1880s, you have the beginning of German theology, modernism, which came in. And they didn't even have a name for it, except they could be called the higher critics. And a handful of believers in this country really did understand what was happening. Most of them didn't have an idea in the world. So you have thousands upon thousands of Baptist churches and a couple and a half million church members, and yet no central organization. 1906. Now you have a small group of modernists, mainly in the University of Chicago Divinity School, who had the idea of uniting all these Baptist churches and organizations into one Northern Baptist Convention. And they pulled it off the following 2 years, proposed it in 1907, 1908 got it organized, and now you have all the Northern Baptists organized into one corporation, which included the Foreign Society, included the Home Mission Society, and publication, and these other groups.
I think you, if I can interrupt, I think you talked about how all the various groups in the North were meeting, mm-hmm. and even met at the same time. They just stayed as distinct organizations. That seems a little foreign to me. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. If you're a Baptist, you have to believe in the autonomy of the local church. Every local church is independent, and it's connected to all the other churches by ropes of sand. And you have fellowship in common, you have interests in common. That's what holds you, because there's no one organization or one denomination like the Methodist Church or the Presbyterian Church, but the Baptist churches. So we got a history of independence, and now suddenly we're organized into not only the Southern Convention below the Ohio River, but the Northern Baptist Convention, which is a new thing. Until then, as you say, you had the anniversaries, you had the big three, the Foreign Society, Home Society, and Publication Society, and then you had the Women's Foreign Society and the Women's Home Mission. I don't know why the details.
And they would they all meet in the same building?
Same building, same week, but they'd have a meeting, let's say, of the Home Mission Society, and then take a recess, and then the Publication Society would meet.
So they would never all be in one room under one roof, just...
Right. They were the same constituency, pretty much, but different business, and united by a common purpose, but not common corporation.
So one real smart guy said, let's put it all under one roof. And
the way it went. And his purpose was unite and control. Now, there's another theory that says divide and conquer, but his theory was unite and control. And that's how the modernists got the whole denomination organized into a convention. And in the convention offices, the only people who gravitated toward those jobs were modernists. The believers, the fundamentalists, they want to get out there in the church and preach. So it was the modernists who gravitated toward the home office, took it over. And by 1920, you have a voting block of a couple of hundred salaried servants, vote as a block, and they're all modernists.
So the misconception is that the Northern Baptist, that I've heard, is the Northern Baptist Convention was hijacked by the modernists. And you would say that that's untrue, correct?
The denomination was hijacked, but the convention, no. They simply took it, they organized it, had it from the beginning.
So the modernists, it started under modernist control.
Well, yes. Now, from there on, what are the important lessons? One important lesson is the power, the centralizing power of a denomination. It gets stronger and stronger. People become more and more dependent on it. In the United States, we've got big government. It's not going to get smaller. In a denomination, you get big government. And so the control from this head office became increasing. A second great lesson came out of the convention of 1922, Indianapolis. By this time, the fundamentalists had an organization called the Fundamentalist Fellowship. And
The Fundamentalist Fellowship, was that the group that met prior to?
They held a pre-convention conference.
Okay.
And they had an organization. And their objective was a gentlemanly protest and maybe even to take back their denomination. So in Indianapolis, they offered a historic confession of faith and moved its adoption as the official confession of faith of the Northern Baptist Convention. When the thing finally was voted on, there was a substitute motion made that clouded the thing. But when it was finally voted on, one-third of the constituency voted for a doctrinal statement. Two-thirds voted against it. And here's the problem. Why in the world would a denomination which is 90% virgin birth, blood atonement believers, why would they vote for against a clear-cut doctrinal statement that said that? And it revealed something, and that is whenever in your church or your school or your mission board or your denomination or your association, you've got a key issue coming up. On the one side, you're going to have fervent people, extremists. On the other side, you're going to have fervent people, extremists. And in the middle, you're going to have a large party of moderates. I don't say modernists, but moderates who don't really want to get involved, don't really want to take a stand. They just want peace in the valley. And when it actually comes to a showdown, they will more probably vote with the unbelievers than they'll vote with the believers. Fascinating thing.
Why is that? Why do you? So you attribute the lack of the vote of the Orthodox statement to really a lack of backbone of the moderates?
Yep. Human nature.
Because they didn't want to give up the unity, supposedly, that they had.
Lack of conviction. If you consider the evangelicals as against the fundamentalists now, fundamentalists have convictions. Evangelicals want to be tolerant. They don't want to be judgmental. And in your denomination or your church, if the evangelical tolerating people can put up with false doctrine, can put up with wrong practices, and be sweet about it and gracious and Christ-like, then that's the direction that the whole organization is going to go.
Hmm. So did the FF give up the fight then?
Pretty much, yeah. They kept their identity, but they wanted to be gentlemanly about it. So they had fights in 23, 24, 25, 26, and essentially accomplished nothing. There was no way to take the denomination back.
Meanwhile, what was the Northern Baptist Convention accomplishing?
Well, they were not out winning souls as a convention. They had a retirement program now called the M&M Board. They had a hammer lock on pulpit placement through the state conventions. The missions were both becoming increasingly modernist as they got young modernist candidates out of modernist schools. So mainly the convention was consolidating its control. And by 1927, it was clear to the believers that they had lost their denomination. They were on the outside looking in. And they knew it by that time. A few began to separate, not very many.
Who were the early separatists?
Probably the earliest one would be Van Asdal. By 1920, he knew that there was no hope for the denomination. He knew that it was modernist. He knew that there was no taking it back. He says, if you designate your money to fundamentalist missionaries, it won't change anything because they're going to get some money anyway, and that just frees up money to send to the modernist missionaries. So Van Asdal was, the first one who saw what was going on.
Talk to me about Van Asdal, because you don't really hear much about him today.
No, he's a forgotten man. But he was the organizer of the BYPU, the Baptist Young People's Union, in 1891. He's a graduate of the old Morgan Park Seminary in Chicago. Man of God, man of vision, a premillennial. In fact, when he was in Grand Rapids, had two pastorates of the Wealthy Street Baptist Church, and the second time was from 1909 until 1933. And if they had been able to laugh him out of town, they would have, for preaching that the Jews were going to go back to Palestine. And, you know, all these Hollanders, they knew that was never going to happen. Palestine was a desert, and all the promises to Israel were fulfilled in the church. How in the world could a man say such a thing in public? Well, anyway, he was a far-seeing premillennial and separatist. He organized the Baptist, really was the organizer of the Baptist Bible Union, even though he never held top office in it. Organized the GARB when the Bible Union as much as died. A far-seeing man of God. Incidentally, my first pastor, and I have faint memories as a little child watching this old man on the platform teaching scripture.
You sat underneath Van Asdal?
Yeah.
So what was the breaking point with the Northern Baptist Convention, with the split off of the conservatives?
Yeah, you have the first group that began coming out was in the, as a group, coming out in the 1930s, and they organized the General Association of Regular Baptist Churches, the GARB, and early on, they organized in 32, early on, about 1938, they took the principle of single affiliation. If you want to join us, you leave the convention first. And it was that single affiliation that marked the movement, and I think kept it on a clear, straight course for half a century. Now, lately, it's come into division, but it had a clear-cut stand, and I think that is the main thing that did it. With the conservative Baptist movement, it was another thing, and I think that's why it came apart quickly.
How is the conservative Baptist different than the GARB?
Mainly because they were suave men. They did not want the reputation of being fighting fundamentalists. When I was in seminary, I asked a friend of mine, Bill, he was a CB, I was nothing. I said, Bill, what's the difference between the CBA and the GARB? He said, well, the GARB are a bunch of fighting fundamentalists. Whereas, he says, you just take the name, the word conservative, it has a better sound to it. We're a prestige group. We got big men. We got big churches. I don't know if you follow my language there, but he was right on target. He knew exactly what he was talking about. It was a prestige organization.
So the CBA allowed dual affiliation then?
Oh, yes.
So you could be a member of the Northern Baptist Convention, keep your retirement, keep everything, but still say you were not of the Northern Baptist Convention? Was that the
Yeah.
Driving force.
You had a conservative bunch of fellows you had fellowship with, men that saw it your way. They believed in the virgin birth, inspiration of the Bible, blood atonement, but still Baptists.
So it was Baptist. It was good old Baptist. It was good. It was orthodoxy without separation, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
And whereas the GRB would be more separatistic. What was the role of Robert Ketchum during that time?
Early on, his first meeting was 33, and early on he was recognized as the man to contend with by sheer character. He was acknowledged to be the leader early on, as I say. And he was essentially the guiding voice as long as he lived. Even when he was out of office, I interviewed him in about 1963, I believe it was. And I remember his remarking rather whimsically. Here he was, almost blind. He held no office. He had an office in the state, in the headquarters there in South Dearborn. But he said, "You would have to say that I still have a voice in the GARB." Well, he had a voice, all right, because he was the gray eminence looked up to at the very last. You know?
There were some fundamentalists during that time that were quite colorful. Shields, Norris, those kind of guys. What part did they play?
Shields was the president of the Baptist Bible Union for most of its life.
How long did the Baptist Bible Union exist?
22 to 32. Okay. 10 years.
And then that merged into the month. Became the GRB.
Yeah, the last meeting of the Bible Union was when they officially dissolved and accepted the name GARB, General Association Regular Baptists. So there was a legal succession there.
Okay. Yeah. And Shields...
By that time he was out of it, but he was the Baptist Pope of Canada, a power broker, a man of God, almost a fundamentalist. He was amillennial, and so that set him a bit over from the rest of them.
Were there three key characters?
Yeah. Shields, Riley, and Norris.
Okay.
Shields was the Pope of Canada, Riley was the Pope of the Northern States, and Norris was the Pope of the South, if I use that word Pope. Dollar called them the prima donnas.
You have a quote in here about Norris, J. Frank Norris. The slanderous and libelous attacks of Mr. J. Frank Norris upon the GRB and men associated were thoroughly gone into, and while it was agreed there was sufficient unimpeachable evidence in our files, which, if published, would brand Mr. Norris forever and evermore as a man utterly devoid of Christian ethics, common courtesy, and trustworthiness, it was decided to follow the policy of silence as far as any published answer to his attacks is concerned, and commit Mr. Norris to the judgment of, quote, him who judgeth righteously, unquote, who has said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So obviously, where some maybe in fundamentalism herald Norris as a great fundamentalist hero, this would tend to cast a different light on Norris's reputation. Is that correct?
Yes. Not that that reputation was very widely understood, but you can make quite a case that Norris is two men, maybe more than two. On the one hand, a powerful evangelist, a powerful pulpit man, tremendous pulpit presence, and tremendous powers of persuasion. And only in eternity may we find out how many people owe their salvation to his preaching, his ministry. On the other hand, everything that this quotation has can be verified. And a strange person, because when it came to Christian grace, no. Now, he was determined to build a big work. He was an egomaniac. His son spoke to a seminar in Dallas Seminary when Dollar was there. And I remember the words that were quoted to me. He said, my dad was the biggest Jesuit there ever was. He would do anything to draw a crowd. And so Norris's great passion was to preach to crowds. and then publish pictures of the crowds.
And then shoot people when they disagreed with him.
At least one. I think it was Ed Nelson. It was Ed Nelson I was talking with. And it was Norris, I'm sure, that he was talking about. But anyway, he went to the great man and he said, "What do I have to do to build a large church?" And Norris said, "Pick a fight." And therefore, Norris had fights going all over Fort Worth. And he fought with the mayor and accused the mayor of being a racketeer, which he probably was. And that was what led to Mayor's Meacham's friend coming over to threaten Norris in July of 1926, and Norris shooting a man to death.
And that was pretty much the ending of Norris's credibility, wasn't it? Because
yeah, it didn't end his ministry, but it ended his credibility. And so that was probably not the worst.
But Norris, he pastored two churches at the same time, didn't he?
Yeah, he was pastor of First Baptist of Fort Worth, and then Temple Baptist of Detroit came open, and he found a way to get himself called to that. And he was commuting back and forth by DC-3, and then the other church, wherever he wasn't, would carry the same message by public address. But then eventually Beecham Vic took over the work at Temple. By a vote of, recorded as 3,000-5, to take Vic over Norris. So Vic became pastor of Temple Baptist.
How long was Vic there?
Let's see. First he went there as what Norris gave him the title of superintendent. That was about 1935. And when did Vic die? It's about 1972, I believe. But it was big. It was a super church, a mega church. Without having to have the entertainments that we need.
Yeah, I think, interestingly enough, that Temple Baptist Church has been, they would still consider themselves independent Baptist, but really are thoroughgoing evangelicals. I mean, it's a mega church still today, but the pastor now is heralded as a church growth expert.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Norris and Vic had a love-hate relationship going all through the 1940s. And then in 48, the school in Fort Worth was in bad financial trouble, and Norris engaged Vic to come back and be the president of the school. Well, Vic didn't want to leave the church, but Norris at least talked him into becoming president. And I think Vic was telling me the truth when he said, "I got it on a sound financial footing. We fired faculty members that the school didn't need, got the thing going well, and one of the terms was, okay, Frank, if you want me to run, I got to have free hand." "Yes, yes, Beecham, yes, okay." But it actually worked out after 2 years. Norris fired Vic as president of the school, installed a Scottish evangelist by the name of Joke Troop, and that ended the love-hate relationship, and the Baptist Bible Fellowship then was organized, 1950. Out of Norris's group, the World Baptist Fellowship.
Hmm. What would you think if we shift here into talking about a denomination? Most of our readers and listeners are independent, and a lot of them are Baptist or Bible-type churches. But sometimes there's an attraction to a denomination because it looks organized. They publish materials that can be a help to a church. But what, over your years of study, have you seen as the dangers of a denomination?
The danger of a denomination is that as it grows in power, the pastor, the members, look on it as a great cow from which we all draw milk, or a great shepherd to whom we look for leadership. I mean, my metaphors are getting mixed there. But the two great controls that a denomination has over a pastor are, first of all, his retirement, if they have a retirement program, and then more than that, pulpit placement. And when the denomination controls pulpit placement, and here the pastor is, let's say, having a hard time, church where he is, not going anywhere, or they're fighting him or something, when he knows that he can call the state secretary or the state missionary, and that very night have a couple of appointments to candidate somewhere, I mean, it's a great deal to him. Security.
So even when, you know, like some denominations would say, well, all of our churches are autonomous, maybe technically they would be autonomous, but there's still some control there, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because the church would still elect the pastor.
Yeah. Now, for example, the GARB has a long history of independence. They don't own any missions. They just endorse them in the so-called approval system. But it's all a rope of sand. Nothing's really connected. I had a precious young couple from Columbia Bible College apply to a GARB mission. I believe it was ABWE. And they were interviewing this executive, and the executive was saying, well, you ought to go to one of our schools, at least take a year or two. And George said, well, what do I do that for? He says, I'm already trained as a missionary in a good school. And he said, well, how do you expect to go out under a GARB mission if you haven't been to a GARB school? And in that moment, the scales fell from everybody's eyes, and they realized that there was an interlocking connection here. And you never find it on a flow chart. But, I mean, it was a brotherhood. It was an establishment. It was a denomination, even though it seemed all informal and didn't have any real connections.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And would you say that you talk about the M&M board with the Northern Baptist Convention, that it was as pragmatic with some men as their retirement, why they would not separate?
Oh, yes. The M&M missionaries, ministers and missionaries benefit board of the Northern Baptist Convention was an excellent retirement program. It was well planned and it was generous. And essentially it meant that if you had a convention church, 2% of your salary went to the M&M, and they would induce the church to provide another matching 8%. So essentially 10% of your salary is going in, carefully invested, and when you finally retired, I think you got 75% of your top salary for life. That was pretty nice. That was before the days of Social Security. So it was a powerful device to keep men in line.
Hmm. Back to the convention real quick. You reference in your paper there was a lack of church membership, a lack of discipline in the churches that really provided the churches, really polluted the churches, I guess, with a number of unbelievers. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I got that out of Vedder's book, A Short History of the Baptists, which was written right at the turn of the century, right about the year 1900. And he comes across with these grievances. He says, here we are, we've got more money, we've got more members than we had before, we're going great guns, other denominations are taking our principles, however. And one of the problems he mentions was that we're not having first-time conversions of adults listening to preaching. We're getting our growth now through the Sunday school. Kids are coming. We do not have church discipline as we used to practice it. And then he had a couple of other concerns. The nature of preaching was one of them. I forget the fourth one right offhand.
So it sounds like what Vedder wrote about in 1900 is the same problem we have today.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lack of discipline, lack of membership.
Well, mass evangelism. There may be places, and I hear of it once in a while, where people are genuinely converted as adults, listening to evangelistic preaching. And most of the time when I hear about these conversions, it turns out that 3 out of 4 can't be found next week, or that they were really dealt with in their home and induced to come to church and come forward in the church to make it look good. When it comes to evangelism from the pulpit, it was still going strong until about World War II. And I have yet to hear of many places, maybe overseas, and there are still, I guess, a few churches in this country that can point to first-time adult conversions. Don't hear many.
Hmm. No. So do you think that there's a lot of unconverted sitting in the pews of American Baptist churches?
Okay.
that's called a softball question.
We talked about this one. And that is, it was a half a century ago that Robert G. Lee of Memphis was preaching to the Southern Baptist Convention. And in the course of his remarks, as I've heard them quoted, he made this statement. He says, "As I have known our beloved denomination and traveled among our churches, I have come to the conclusion that not more than 15% of our members have any saving knowledge of Christ." And the room went silent, this huge auditorium convention. And he kind of staggered back for a moment, kind of blinked, and he said, "What did I say? How could I ever have made a statement like that? 15%. And he yelled, "I should have said 10%. You know, when you think of not any one particular convention or denomination, I think of Brooks of St. Louis talking with A.T. Pearson. Pearson had meetings in Brooks's church, and Brooks is a fine fundamentalist Presbyterian. He said, "You know," Pearson had asked him, "How many of your people are really saved?" He said, "As I've ministered to these, I can hardly hope that more than 20% of my members have any real saving knowledge of Christ." Hmm. So when it comes to unsaved church members, there are a lot of places.
That's sad. I mean, what would you prescribe as the cure for that problem?
Preaching the word. And the kind of prayer life that goes with it. Because, you know, Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall, had a great fall, all the king's horses and all the king's men, all our energies, all our programs are not going to put an unsaved person back together. It's got to be the power of the Spirit of God, I think, in response to believing prayer, but as it comes out in clear exposition of Scripture. If that doesn't, I don't know what will.
Okay. I want to close with the hallmarks of a fundamentalist. As you look back on studying fundamentalist history, you're a classic church historian. What would you say are the hallmarks of a fundamentalist?
I think, and I came on this a long time ago, but I've never found much occasion to review it or revise it. But the first mark is a love for Scripture. Cover to cover and the covers too, plenary verbal inspiration, the plain sense of Scripture. Now that doesn't mean that you don't correct your English Bible by your Greek Testament, but the ministry of the Word's got to be the first one. Really love the Word. Then if you really love the Word, you're going to become a premillennial, a dispensationalist indeed. So the second mark of a fundamentalist is he believes in the pre-trib rapture, the premillennial return of Christ, that the church is not Israel, that the kingdom is yet future. Second mark.
Do you believe on that second mark that there is toleration for different eschatological views? Because even in the document you wrote, you talked about how they took out a belief in the rapture way back when.
Yeah, that was to accommodate Shields. But as soon as Shields had left the movement and they revised the doctrinal statement, then they got it straight again. And I believe you'll find that the doctrinal statement of the GARB is what I would call straight, clear.
Okay.
So I trust that we're gracious Christian gentlemen, and I love my father of my niece by marriage, who is a preterist and a non-millennial, and we get along tolerably well, but I don't approve of his theology, and he doesn't approve of mine, but at least we can be decent, you know.
But can a Presbyterian who doesn't hold to these views still be considered a fundamentalist?
No, but he's still a friend, still a brother. I think by definition, if a person doesn't believe in the message of the kingdom, he's going to leave some of the other things too. J.C. Massey, one time, long about 1941, was preaching in Northwestern's chapel, and he had lunch with Clearwaters. And in the course of lunch, Clearwaters quoted Massey as saying, "Clearwaters, when are you going to get over this Jewish eschatology of yours? I got over that long ago." Well, he not only got over his premillennialism long ago, but he got over his separation likewise. So they tend to go together. Third mark, you know what the third mark is? Third mark is separatism. And that is, when there are apostates out there, we may yearn over them, we may weep over them, we may in a measure love them, but we can't make common cause and we can't have them on our platform to lead in prayer. There has to be separation. And then if there's separation, then there's a fourth mark, and that is what I'll call conviction or militancy. We feel strongly about things. They're not just a bunch of opinions. Now, having said that, I came to a fifth mark, because there are great leaders who hold all four, but men that you would not want to buy a used car from, and that is, they are scoundrels. And you get too close and you realize that when it comes to a clear-cut, honest, consistent Christian testimony, they look good from across the hall, but they're not the same men when they're close up. I remember Clearwater saying that about W.B. Riley. When you're close up, he looks different. And therefore, I suggest a fifth mark, and that is the fundamentalist par excellence is the man who walks with God. And that described Ketchum, and described a number of men I could name, but it doesn't describe them all.
Yeah, you said on that fifth point, this is where the road forks. Explain that.
There are young fellows I know. I'm thinking of several, but one particularly. I taught with him years ago at Piedmont. He had gone to what is reputed to be a fundamentalist school, and he sat under the preaching and the discipline and all that, and when he finally got out of it, he wanted nothing to do with a position that he identified as fundamentalism. And I grieve. I talked with him. I tried to minister to his soul, argued with him. Never got to first base because he could never be persuaded that out there beyond 300 miles of where he went to school, there was a fundamentalism much bigger, much wider, with a spiritual reality that he never knew. And I think of the young guys, many of them out there, who would gravitate toward separatism and biblicism and premillennialism and indeed have common cause and fellowship with one another if they didn't have such a bad taste in their mouths of that word fundamentalism. And that's why I add that fifth mark.
And the bad taste in their mouth because of maybe bad leadership?
Yeah, yeah. If somebody were to ask me, what are the greatest problems that fundamentalism has had, or our movement, or our ideal, better, I like the way Bowder said, we're not a movement, we're an idea. And why has the idea been rejected? And I think maybe our greatest problem was the careless choice of personnel. Either the leaders that we followed who built big churches, or the people that we hired to work with us. And I think that matter of earnest, prayerful, careful consideration of personnel may be the most important thing we're going to have to do in the days ahead.
If you could say something to a bunch of young men in their 20s and 30s who were either training for church ministry, who were currently church leaders, or we're serving in a leadership capacity in a local church, what message would you like to communicate to them?
The message I'd like to communicate is that even though the word fundamentalist has been battered around and in some cases badly represented, I don't know of anybody that's come up with a better term yet. And that's why, at least here, as long as I define it, or as long as you define it, is a word that turns out to be handy. But I'm not so concerned, brethren, that you hold the word. What I am concerned about is you hold the principles, and that is of an honest, faithful, experiential walk with God. That you love the Bible. That you believe in the any moment return of Christ. That you separate from apostates and don't make common cause with them. And that, well, I'll describe it this way, you're men, you don't have any opinions, they're all convictions. You got to figure that last one out.
Well, thank you for your time.
Sharper Iron is a blog and forum whose mission is to edify Christian brothers and sisters by providing a place to publish and discuss news and ideas from a Christian, biblical, and fundamentalist worldview.